But today it is VE Day. The war is over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
landed. Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Marx Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Marx Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Wealth Show. I'm Zach, a reporter at Citywire Wealth Manager, and welcome to our 2024 roundup of the year. Joining me today are fellow reporters Natalia Vaznier and Sophie Downs. How are you guys? Welcome to our yearly roundup podcast.
Hi, it's good to be here.
This has been your first year into covering wealth management for both of you. How have you found it?
Yeah, so I joined in June, and it was kind of immediately diving in the deep end. There was a lot going on, getting involved in particular a lot with regulation, but yeah, there's not been a dull day since.
What about you, Natalia?
Yeah, I have to agree. I joined in August this year, so it's a little bit calmer because everybody was on holiday. But then obviously the budget came a few weeks later in the US election, so lots been happening, and it's really, really exciting place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't really know where to start, to be honest. It's been such a big year. I think kicking off, I'd have to start by saying, you know, it's been a very tough year for wealth managers. Another very difficult economic climate. We've seen, you know, a variety of job cuts. I mean, I think the year started off with Aberdeen announcing 500 job cuts. That was 10% of their workforce after years of outflows for them. You know, that's been a company that's had numerous changes in focus, with a sort of shift to interactive investor, and a real sort of move away from financial planning, really. But that was literally in January. So the bad news sort of started early. We'll get into some of the other job cuts as well. In terms of other wealth movements, you know, we had what was massive for us was Close Brothers selling to private equity. And, you know, this represents sort of latest in a trend of wealth managers selling up to private equity. And also just a reflection of how difficult these market conditions really are. You know, they sold to private equity firm Oak Trees in September. For up to £200 million. I think we broke the news in July that sale process was ongoing. And of course, Oak Tree also own Atomos. So it's been taken out by private equity that already has experience.
Yeah, jumping on that, don't you feel like there's been quite a lot of M&A activity in the space this year? Like, I was talking to a few wealth managers who were saying maybe there was less opportunities for M&A activity to happen.
There has been opportunity in the space. I think it's a very interesting conversation we have with private equity at the moment. A lot of brokers, in the M&A space are telling me that the time for private equity was a few years ago, and it's still rife. And there's still far more that it has to go in this sector. However, valuations were pretty crazy a few years ago for businesses. They're now coming off a little bit. We're now seeing a lot of firms saying they feel that they've missed the boat. A lot of private equity firms saying that they've missed the boat and that the boat was a few years ago. Having said that, you've also got to stack that up with ever-growing costs for wealth managers and an incentive to sell to private equity. So it's a really interesting discussion that I'm sure is going to continue to go on. I mean, I've been speaking about, you know, we've been speaking about private equity for years and years and years now. But yeah, that market play is quite interesting. And of course, what's also interesting is the amount of debt being loaded onto companies, you know, often from PE firms. I mean, there was a fantastic investigation in Citywire just today at the time of recording, actually, of the £3.4 billion of debt. You can read this on Citywire, Wealth Manager and New Model Advisor. Investigation, how £3.4 billion of debt has changed the face of financial advice. And these are combed from sort of Companies House and other accounts that we could find. And it includes, you know, a lot of wealth managers as well. You know, Evelyn, we found £400 million worth of debt in their accounts. You know, Atomos, £75 million worth of debt in their accounts. There are a lot of, and it remains True Potential, obviously the main outlier, with over £1 billion worth of debt. And, you know, it's interesting getting people's opinions on this, you know, because a lot of consolidators will say, well, you know, debt is aim of the game, you know, well, there's always a trust that that will be repaid at some point. But then, of course, you can completely see the other angle, which is that, hold on, how sustainable is this? When you're talking about, you know, some firms over £1 billion worth of debt, and by the way, these figures are probably an undershoot because we couldn't get access to all of the accounts. You know, various firms based in Jersey, for example, and that's got its own company's house. So yeah, it's an extremely interesting move in the market. And I have to say as well, from a wealth manager perspective, in terms of big sort of wealth moves happening this year as well, Brooks, you know, sold its international arm, £51 million, to Canaccord Genuity, which is obviously massive news for our readers. And this was after Brooks launched a strategic review of the Jersey-based international arm in March, after that took an £11.6 million hit on value. So this is really interesting as well. This is another sort of refocus by a wealth manager, this time to focus on its UK business after this sort of drive to, you know, look after international clients. And it's now just sort of retreating back to, you know, its sort of core investment, its core activities of UK investment management and UK financial planning. That deal's going to complete next March. So yeah, it's really interesting times.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, it's been a very busy year for Brooks. And we can't forget, obviously, the changes in leadership.
So yeah, this was the end of Andrew Shepherd's reign after 3 years in the job. There are so many changes at Brooks as well. After that happened as well, the former COO left, a classic sort of leadership change after a new CEO comes on board. You know, it's really interesting. We've also seen, of course, the continuation of a lot of leavers from Brooks Macdonald. So yeah, it's certainly challenging times for wealth managers. And as I say, all of this sort of contributes, the difficult economic climate contributes to an incentive to sell to private equity, really. So I think that's why we're seeing more of that in the space. And of course, the other, this is talking about the wealth moves in the industry this year. The other thing that's affected wealth managers massively is SDR for those sustainable players in the space. So yeah, Sophie, do you mind talking to us a little bit about what SDR is and why it caused so many wealth managers such problems this year?
Yeah, I mean, regulation's always, I think, a huge talking point in the industry. I think this year the biggest player was definitely SDR. So it might be helpful if we think about timings a little bit. So November 2023, the FCA published its final policy statement on the regulation. And this laid out specific deadlines for 2024. So that you could say there was a kind of idea about how this was going to go, how this might play out. And I think maybe is the case with all regulations. What we've seen is that, you know, it's not so easy and it's a lot more difficult when you try and put it in practice. Yeah, so I guess I think something that Citywire has covered extensively over the year has been fund managers' troubles with getting the labels. And, you know, this is despite, I think there's a huge support for SDR. There was a lot of greenwashing before. You know, everyone agrees it's the right principle and, you know, it's been created with genuine intentions. But matching the deadlines, and the FCA has been leading with a principles-based approach rather than being too prescriptive. And this has meant that, you know, people are struggling in how you would define sustainable. So there is a genuine support for it. And I think there's still appetite for it even now, but there does seem to be people still struggling with how they can match this and how they can play up to this regulation.
Yeah. And I guess the FCA is in a sticky place because obviously you want to avoid greenwashing and you want to take sustainable funds to truly mean sustainable. It's interesting, you know, a few weeks ago we had Chris Welsford on the podcast, Natalia, and he was talking about research he was doing into sustainable funds. Do you think that the FCA, do you think that these measures will go far enough to eliminate greenwashing?
I think that's kind of a wait. I think, like, when it comes to SDR, it's been kind of like a wait and see approach of who was going to get the labels and see if it actually is going to have a positive impact. I know that I've been talking to a few people in the MPS space who are a bit more cautious when it came to SDR. Mainly a piece that came out a few weeks ago was how Tatton was actually warning that if kind of portfolios, ethical portfolios, sustainable portfolios in MPS models were going to like go for the label, then they would have all of the same funds within their ethical sustainable portfolios. That would lead to like more less competition between providers, because ultimately they would have all of the same funds and they would all be kind of competing for clients with the same kind of portfolios, which was not great. And I think that's something that the FCA and mainly what Tatton was telling us hasn't looked into enough yet. I think obviously like in the podcast that we had with Chris Wellsford, he was more looking at kind of what was within those sustainable funds and if they were actually really kind of meeting ethical and sustainable rules and guidelines. And what clearly came out from it was that most of them were not. And I think FCA is obvious, like the FCA SDR regime is obviously a step in the right direction. But I think when it comes to the MPS space specifically, I think there's kind of more conversations that need to be had between kind of providers
and again, the regulator is also in a sticky place because, you know, when you announce these labels, and it's been fun being in the office when this has happened, because we've sort of been following it every week, like keeping up with football scores, which firms are going to get labels, right? And, you know, one week it's, oh, there's a label, maybe it's, you know, firms are taking this seriously. And then the next it's, well, Stuart investors are rejecting this label entirely and are telling everyone they are. And of course, for the FCA, you need enough big firms to acquire labels for it to mean something, right? Otherwise, the whole system's in chaos. So it'll be very interesting to see how that space continues.
Because we did an article a few weeks ago, myself and Jeremy, and it was actually discussing whether SDR would reach critical mass or not. And for this, we spoke to people across the industry. You know, I think on the back of big names like Vanguard and Stuart Investors, who is of course Stuart in the sustainable investing space, and if they're dropping out, what might that mean if other firms follow suit? And I know from conversations we've been having with fund managers, they are thinking of dropping out, which would of course, you know, throw this whole regulation into the air. But I think it's been reassuring seeing more and more firms coming through with labels in the past few months, or maybe last month. It hasn't been going on for that long, but we can only hope that this will continue into 2025.
And in the piece, wasn't it like 18 funds so far who managed to receive 18 the label, funds. Right?
Yeah, but I think that was a statistic the FCA gave us. But we've heard from so many since that I think that number's been easily surpassed. So yeah, it's all good stuff. It's, you know, it's looking quite positive, I think. There's definitely positive appetite in the industry. I think just you do have obviously some dissent around it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think there was a case of a bit of a knee-jerk reaction from fund managers being told that they had to, you know, to just FCA regulation in general, and that as time beds in, it will actually slowly get more and more support from firms?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a case of, you know, when people see other firms, you know, getting these labels, seeing maybe there's a commercial advantage as well, it might encourage it. I mean, it's also worth noting that there's still a lot of questions up in the air. So there's been extensions, so naming and marketing rules and SDR for portfolio managers were originally meant to, you know, the date of adhering to these was the 2nd of December, and that's been pushed back to April now. But there's also questions around, you know, is this going to work for passive funds? Because that's a point of division across the industry. So there's a lot of things, you know, to be worked out still. I think it's very fair to say the regulation's in its early stage. So yeah, I guess, you know, it's what we've been hearing across the industry, but we can only reiterate, you know, that time will tell.
Yeah, and I think it kind of makes the regulator sort of makes their job harder when they have to push back deadlines, because I think trust in the process then just gets diminished. And I think more and more so.
It's almost like critics of that regulation are kind of, you know, given more wind if it's shown to not be doing very well. But I think the future's looking good.
Okay. Well, that sounds positive, positive for those players. Sophie, you've been on the phone with sort of fund managers talking to you about the labels. Have you sort of colloquially, have you had any kind of backlash on the phone from them about SDR, or have you seen, like...
Of course, yeah. I mean, as I said, I think people are very supportive of the intention of the regime. You know, no one wants greenwashing. But it's just adhering to, you know, what can be quite a difficult regulation, and people still don't really understand what the FCA are asking for. I mean, we did an article, it's a couple of months ago now, but talking to DFMs across the industry, and I think our headline was, I'd like a holiday this year. And I think that really feeds into this idea that, you know, people felt quite ill-prepared for it, and maybe feel like the amount of work they have to do, you know, is just a bit unrealistic. So, I mean, the extensions are a good place to start, because obviously people are going to have more time. But, you know, I guess it's not what the FCA originally intended. But, you know, the aim of the game here is to get as many people using these labels and doing essentially what they said they've been doing. So even if it takes a longer time, I think the main answer to it is that we get there eventually.
Yeah. And Natalia, have you heard any sort of criticism or support from the regulator sort of over the phones about the way the process could have been handled a bit better?
I think from conversations that we've had, I kind of reiterate Sophie's point. I think people were just more taking a wait and see approach and see who was actually going to get the labels first, and then kind of copy the model that they were taking. I think there was a lot of them, like we were saying in Sophie's piece, who kind of just rejected the label altogether because it would just be too complicated to install as well within their portfolios. I think it's kind of a mixed reaction, but I think the fact that more and more are actually receiving the labels, I think that's kind of like a positive step forward as well. But I think initially when it happened a few months back, people would just wait and see what was going to happen and not really take the first step. It was very, a lot of caution, like kind of walking on eggshells in a sense.
Yeah. And, you know, in the broader MPS space, Natalia, what have we seen this year in terms of the actual MPS industry? I know there's been a sort of slowdown in new launches.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the MPS space this year has been really interesting because over the past few years, there's been kind of a massive hike in launches in the MPS space, whether it's like regular MPS portfolios or even sustainable launches. But what a Morningstar study revealed this year was that there was actually a huge decline in launches. And I think that was kind of because the industry was kind of reaching this maturation point where all of the big providers who could have kind of launched did launch and have actually managed to kind of branch out their kind of propositions. And kind of new providers coming into the space this year are faced with challenges of price wars, with kind of providers trying to be more competitive, specifically Timeline, who's offering really kind of a competitive price range. There's also been like kind of all of the services that could be offered have been offered in a sense, which is really interesting because at Citywire, we're really lucky to have a really kind of in-depth MPS database, specifically Dan Grote, who's done some amazing articles this year, kind of deep dive analysis on the top MPS providers in the space and kind of who's top of the pack. So I think Quilter, Tatton and Timeline are the top three. And also a really interesting kind of article that came out was that 9 out of 10 passive MPS portfolio actually managed to beat their active counterparts. So I think in the MPS space, a huge trend is that passive has been the direction, the route kind of travel so far. And coming back to that kind of point of launches in the MPS space, there have been launches, even though there's been like a huge decline, there have been launches this year, specifically talking about like Premium Iton. So they launched an MPS earlier this year. It was in spring. And a few months later, they hired Chris Robinson from Tatton to come onto the team of Premium Iton to focus on their MPS. And I think what was interesting is I was talking to a few different MPS providers who were already settled in the space, who were saying that they were thinking that the new launches were going to remain subscale because they weren't going to be able to branch out. And speaking with Chris, I think what was interesting, the key point that came out was how that DFMs who are launching in the space should not compete with advisors, but rather work with them hand in hand. And he was talking how there's like a few key points to have to be able to successfully kind of scale, which is kind of having like that experienced team, having a long track record and kind of be profitable, being able to compete within the space when it comes to like prices. And so I think, yeah, there's been a lot of things going on in the space this year. It's really exciting kind of sector to be writing about.
Yeah, definitely. And that point about prices being competitive, do you see sort of this, we often talk about this race to the bottom, in terms of MPS pricing. Are you seeing that pan out this year?
I think, yeah, definitely that kind of race to the bottom has been a concern for providers that I've been speaking to. I think that you can only go so far, right? Because if you just keep racing to the bottom, then you just don't make profit and then you just don't make money. So that's kind of why that could kind of be a reason for the decline in launches as well this year. I think mainly when it came to like decline in sustainable portfolio launches, I think that was linked mainly to SDR.
Interesting.
And also because over the past 3 years, like mainly, so there was like a huge launch of sustainable MPS, like I think in 2020 or like a few years back. And then kind of there have been a bad performance over the past few years when it came to those portfolios. And so people have just kind of been taking a step back, and then SDR just kind of cut people's mood, like kind of intentions within. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I know you've been speaking to so many people across in the MPS space, Natalia. And I know you put out an article yesterday on rebalancing, and I know that's been a big theme. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think rebalancing, so all different MPS providers, so most of them generally rebalance on a quarterly basis. So I think there was an interesting piece I did a few weeks ago from Forvis Mazars. Their CIO, Ben Seeger-Scott, was just talking about how he was locking in the profits from gold and kind of allocating that back to US tips because it was something that he seemed kind of a bit more kind of sure to do so. And I think what's interesting in the MPS space is just how different providers have kind of different strategies when it comes to rebalances, whether it's tactical asset allocation or strategic asset allocation. For example, yesterday I did a piece on how Beckett Asset Management just was kind of moving away from alternatives and back into bonds. That was just because, so Tony Yusufian, who is the kind of portfolio manager at Beckett, was believing that kind of equities and bonds were going to come back to their traditional role in markets. And so he was kind of seeing more opportunity there. Well, when we were talking to Ben Seeger-Scott, he was kind of swapping high yield bonds for government emerging market debt because he was seeing you could kind of get more value for the risk that you were taking. So I think these are kind of really niche areas when it comes to kind of investment and asset allocation. And it's always really interesting to kind of understand the backstory behind why people are kind of changing their allocations. And I know now is kind of the period of 2025 outlooks. And so we've been receiving a lot of commentary on the outlook for the next few years. And I know that kind of the US elections and what's happening in that space.
And it's interesting, you mentioned the US elections as well. I want to just ask you about that sustainability point, because, you know, the MPS data showed as well showed that, you know, a lot of sustainable funds were struggling. You know, we talk about, you mentioned the US elections, you know, the incoming president, Donald Trump, which may be good for some elements of wealth management, maybe not so good for others. We spoke a bit this year about a sort of general ESG backlash and a sort of retreat from the sort of fashion of the last few years where ESG came to the forefront, really. Have you seen that actually taken place? Do you think that's a bit of a myth?
Kind of like the backlash towards ESG. I think, so, I mean, at Citywire, we host a lot of events across the year. And I think we've been talking to, I mean, Sophie, Zach, and like, we've all been talking to different wealth managers, kind of getting their initial reactions during events. And I think, I mean, to be fair, like Trump's election was kind of seen as a positive thing for markets in general. There was like a poll that we did, I think, it was at the wealth manager retreat a few months ago, and people were kind of more positive about kind of the impact it would have compared to kind of having like the Democratic party in power.
Wasn't it in the 80? It was like 80 something percent.
It was quite 80, surprising. 80-20, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it just comes from kind of his pro-growth, pro-business angle. Obviously, like, when he was elected, during his first mandate, I think the initial reaction from the market was rather positive. And so I think people are kind of expecting the same thing to happen this time. But yeah, what do you think, Zach? What's kind of been your take on the US elections from conversations you've had?
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, listeners will be aware of what happened in the US election. We didn't need to intro that for a UK podcast. But yeah, it's interesting because I think hand in hand, you have from being at those, you mentioned those events, from being at those events and speaking to everyone, you sort of get this sense of, well, his sort of low tax US business approach and his sort of, you know, pro-growth approach in general, there's a sense that that will be good for markets, and that, and you know, that's reflected in the sort of confidence, in the market confidence, you know, after Trump's victory. But then there's also this sense of, well, he's a notoriously unstable politician and markets crave stability, and people crave stability, right? So I think those two things work hand in hand, because people are, you know, business leaders as well are afraid of an unstable environment, because generally instability is bad for business, right? I mean, I remember doing these podcasts with where we had the fallout of Liz Truss's mini budget, and a sort of right wing sort of deregulation, cascade of deregulation, really. And that was not good for business. So I think it's, again, it's a bit of a wait and see approach. I mean, of course, Trump's got a, of course, in the elections as well, it was not just, you know, the president, it was the Congress, it was the House of Representatives. So Trump's got a lot more power this time around as well. So yeah, I think I think it's interesting where that will go, and where the sort of what that means for sustainability in general, really, not just in terms of our space. But yeah, speaking of elections, of course, we had the big one over here. Obviously, was Labour getting in power for the first time in over 17 years?
I think 14 years.
Years. Well, yeah. Check us up on that, but 14 years. So Keir Starmer's first government. We'll get into his budget, obviously, which is the biggest thing for wealth managers. But I wanted to ask you both what your sense is from wealth managers about the Labour government, what their attitude is towards them. I mean, you know, we've been at these events and we often ask at our events, we ask poll questions of the audience in the room. And often those are about politics. So yeah, have you heard much sort of praise for Keir Starmer? A good reaction to his budget? A bad? What was going on?
I think from my part, it's been predominantly bad. I think it's a difficult thing with politics because, you know, officially people don't always like to comment on it. So, you know, but in discussions you have with people, I think there was a real sense of resentment, particularly around the budget. And, you know, before we even go into the exact changes he made, I think the huge gap between them coming into power and them releasing the budget really got people's backs up. And, you know, if people were having clients come to them saying, can we do this, and this? And, you know, all they could really say was, you know, don't make any rash decisions, wait and see what happens. And obviously we've had the huge fallout with the taking the pension tax-free lump sum. So I think that was a big point of concern, I think, from what I was hearing from wealth managers. What about you, Nicole?
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are like valid points that I've also heard. I think what kind of from a more investment point of kind of point of view, I think political stability was actually seen as a really positive thing. I know I did a few pieces on kind of the view of the UK equity market, and quite a lot of wealth managers actually, because they were anticipating a Labour win, already was allocating more to the UK equity space and mainly to the UK small cap equity space. And so I think kind of the election of Keir Starmer and kind of coming back of a more stable government and not changing every few weeks or months was seen as a really positive sign. But the only question mainly following the budget was actually, how are they going to fund this kind of growth? How are they going to, is it kind of really sustainable? And I remember I was talking to one wealth manager who was saying, like, does Rachel Reeves actually really understand what growth means? And which I think is kind of an interesting kind of point of discussion to have.
Definitely. And it was interesting because, you know, I had a lot of wealth managers saying to me, well, Rachel Reeves has kind of boxed herself into a corner because she said she wouldn't raise. There was the big kerfuffle as well over her saying she's not going to raise taxes for working people. But then, of course, employers' national insurance goes up and you're thinking, well, that will get passed down to working people.
Yeah, it's a knock-on effect.
So there was a whole thing, drama about her definition of working people. But ultimately, with her ruling out those, you know, classic income tax rises, she was put in a corner because she needed to fix this deficit. She needs to raise money for investment. So how are you going to do that, really? And you're going to have to make some unpopular decisions about which taxes you're going to have to up. And there was also, I think, an element of, there was a period just before the budget politically where they tried to get everyone's expectations really bad, which is an interesting strategy. And then, to some extent, that worked because, you know, I had a few wealth managers saying to me, well, look, it's not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah,
I think that headline. Yeah, I think a headline we went for at one point was breathed a sigh of relief. And that, I think, to be honest, was a political manoeuvring because it was just setting ourselves up for the worst possible case scenario and then saying, well, actually, it's not that bad. I must stress that that was only a certain portion of wealth managers that I spoke to. A lot of them did say it was, you know, Armageddon. And a lot of them were very unhappy. You know, I had a lot of business owners sort of telling me that there's a sort of triple hit on their business due to the budget. You know, I had some business owners telling me that there was a bit of a triple hit on their businesses. You know, there was the national wage increasing. There was a reduction in the salary threshold from which you pay national insurance from £9,100 down to £5,000. And then there was the increase in national insurance up to 15%. You know, I think that was difficult for businesses to take. But at the same time, we're facing a very difficult time in our country economically. So, you know, there was a certain thing of, well, taxes were going to have to get raised.
And I mean, what would, because we've all been talking to people and I'm interested in the conversations, you know, what were the biggest concerns, I guess, post-budget? You know, what are people most concerned about now?
From a wealth perspective, I think the news that pensions will be subject to inheritance tax is massive for them, partly because it means that there's just a lot more work to do because, you know, a lot more work to do deciding whether, you know, what to do with your pension. You know, a lot of people would never touch it because of those benefits. I think that they, I also think that, yeah, the changes to non-DOMs, of course, I mean, we were covering that a lot because that was sort of leaked beforehand. And that they would, you know, that a lot of firms would struggle with, not struggles per se, but a lot of firms would have to do much more work with overseas clients. I know, I think it was Sophie, you wrote a piece about, you know, Canaccord reporting a 56% jump in clients looking to move their assets outside the UK. Yeah. I mean, that's massive, right?
It's staggering because I think with every kind of budget, you're going to, I think there's talk of people leaving the company and having this mass exodus of wealth leave the UK. But almost like, you know, I think with this one, firms were reporting actual evidence of it happening. So yeah, I guess that remains to be seen. There's a new regime that's coming in, obviously, that Labour introduced. But yeah, it could be a time of massive fluctuations and people leaving the UK, which has got people's backs up.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And it's, I just want to ask you a couple questions about on that, Sophie, because it's interesting. So for that piece, you spoke to firms that, you know, deal with overseas clients and are sort of not necessarily based in the UK either. And it's interesting just because from a journalist's perspective, we cover UK clients, right? And we cover UK firms. So did you find a perspective overseas slightly different to one in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to a lot of wealth firms based in the UAE, actually. And obviously Dubai has become this huge hotspot. And I think from their perspective, you know, they're speaking to clients who see no advantage of staying in the UK when there's so many tax benefits offered by these other countries. So it was kind of hearing, you know, both in the UK and from outside the UK that this is a real thing and it is something, you know, that kind of transcends just talk and rumour, I suppose. But I guess that's something we'll have to see over, you know, the next few years and the data of how many people are actually leaving. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting, you know, it could have, you know, wide repercussions for the UK. I know it's something people are really concerned about.
Yeah, and maybe just like an additional question on that. Like through those conversations, do you feel like it's going to be a trend that's going to increase over the next year or so?
Yeah, I think so. From what I've been hearing, you know, people were kind of already ready to leave. And I think that's actually a point. I don't think, you know, a kind of idea that kept coming up in these conversations was that it's not just the budget, you know, getting people to leave. It's the fact that there's been COVID and, you know, the fallout across the UK. There's been Brexit. There's been, you know, quite a fragmented and unstable government, really, you know, frequent changes. And they're kind of, I guess, have set the scene for this budget to be kind of the final stage of this. But yeah, so I think from these conversations, it seems that, yeah, this is something we'll be seeing.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that also 2024 was the year where, you know, we've hopefully left a lot of the COVID era sort of news behind, hopefully. But of course, culturally and economically, it's still very much with us. In October, the FCA announced that they were keeping their 60% of working days at home policy till the end of next year, although that's under review. It's interesting. So at the very start of the year, we had a sort of work from home debate. And we were asking actually a bunch of financial advisors what they thought. And the headline of that actually was, if you don't like it, leave. So I think that's fairly conclusive for some advisors on what they think about it. A lot of them sort of shunning a more flexible approach. I'd be interested to know, because of course, you know, we're sort of slightly younger journalists. We're far younger than any of the wealth managers we cover. I'd be interested to know what your approaches are to working from home and what you think wealth managers should be thinking about it, you know, because there's a case of professional development of just staying in the office. And there's also a case of work-life balance, you know, particularly a lot of women want to have kids and want to spend more time with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of a working from home policy. I think getting the balance is so important, though. And I think especially, you know, I've been here 6 months now, and I think when you're first starting out, it's so important, or I felt, to be around people and even just being able to go and talk to people and have conversations with, and I'm sure this would be the same across the industry, like it is a very vital skill. And I think maybe it's about, you know, learning at what point you can kind of step back and think, actually, you know, I know enough now to delegate properly at home, to do these things. But yeah, I'm in support of it. I think, as you said, I think for women especially, it's been really helpful with children and work-life balance. Yeah, and I think from conversations I've had, I was actually quite surprised. I think in London, you know, the hybrid working model seems to be so popular. But then I think I went to the North Retreat, and it, you know, I was talking to someone who said that a lot of the firms up there were in every day. And that was just the general expectation. Like, no one really thought anything of it. So it's interesting to me that, you know, it might change based on where you are and kind of region. But yeah, I think maybe it's a case of whatever works for the company and their employees. Because I suppose everyone's going to have such different requirements, aren't they, and preferences. What do you think, Natalia?
Yeah, no, I have to agree with you. I think it really depends on how you work best as well as a person, whether it's just like you're in every day. Some, like at City, where we have some people who are in most days. I mean, we work like 3 days in office and then 2 days at home. And I think that's a good balance, because then, like, talking purely from like a journalist kind of perspective, it's just that most of the days I work from home, it's just for writing or just doing meetings. And then in person is just when you go into the city and meet most wealth managers that we talk to. And I think a lot of the wealth managers just kind of take the same approach, as like three, four days in the office. I mean, most of them also travel for conferences as well. But I think mainly, like Sophie was saying, I joined 4 months ago. So I think having the first few months just being as often as possible in person is just a great way to learn and kind of understand like what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. How much would, you know, full-time being in the office impact your decision to take a job, for example?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it depends. You know, if you love a company and you are really confident about the work that you do, then I don't think having to go in 5 days is any sort of chore. I think you just accept it. I think it's also so easy to forget that, you know, years ago, not even the long ago before COVID, it was just the general thing and everyone did it. I think it's easy to forget, and I think people can be a bit lax with it, but you know, the hybrid model is great. I personally, look, I'm all for it. But yeah, I suppose I don't personally, it wouldn't affect me taking a job if it was a job I really, really wanted. I don't know how you guys feel.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you, Sophie. Thank you, Natalia, for a great podcast. And yeah, all your work this year. I hope our lead listeners appreciate it.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, thanks. Zach.
You've been listening to the Wealth Show's Roundup of the Year, featuring myself, Zach Sharif, and fellow reporters Sophie Downs and Natalia Vaznier. For any questions, please feel free to email us at wmnews@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening. Have a Merry Christmas from all of us at Citywire Wealth Manager, and we'll see you in the new year.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing landed. Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.